Mentally Healthy Leaders from Thoughtify.
I'm Tom Fox, and in 2015, I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. Before working in the IT and financial services sectors in the City of London, I'd been a soldier. The warning signs had been there for years, but I didn't recognise them. My own mental health journey inspired me to help others. I now train mental health first aiders and deliver courses within major international corporations to help people manage stress and anxiety, as well as working with the NHS as a mental health advisor. Open conversations about mental health have to start at the top of an organisation. In this podcast, I'll be speaking to influential leaders who have all experienced their own struggle with mental health or illness to find out what they've learned on their journey to recovery and what advice they can give to others. Today's guest is one of the leading voices in mental health support in the workplace. Tim Munden, the Global Chief Learning Officer of Unilever, has created programs which aim to inspire a billion people worldwide to look after their health and well-being. But it was when he first started developing these programs that he realized he had his own demons to tackle. From being injured out of an army career before it started, to having a near-death car crash that brought him years of harrowing nightmares, and the driving forces in his own career that have helped and hindered him over the years, he's here to discuss them all. Tim, it's a great pleasure to have you here today, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. It's really great to be with you, Tom.
Thank you, Tim. Tim, so much of your career has been in HR, but you almost joined the army, didn't you? What happened there then? How come you didn't join?
So I decided when I was about 15 that I wanted a career in the army. I got an army scholarship to help through school, and then actually got support to go to university with a cadetship. And it didn't come off because I basically got injured playing soccer. And whilst I was at Sandhurst, it didn't heal. And I got retired at the age of 22. So having set off down that route, it just turned out that wasn't what the universe had in mind for me.
Yeah, it just goes to show, doesn't it? We can, you never quite know what's around the corner. It must have been quite distressing, or it must have been quite upsetting for you at the time, I suppose.
Yeah, I think so. It was. I was disorientated. And I'd made all my plans around that. That was the most experience I had. at the same time, and so it was upsetting, but at the same time I also think it's worked out really for the best. And actually one of the things that really helped me was I met somebody who really changed my life through that process. I'd gone to him for some career advice, and he said to me, look, next time you choose a career, ask yourself two questions. What do you really love, and what do you want to learn about? And I thought, those are really good questions. And I went away, and for a few weeks I thought about them. I thought, well, basically I really love human beings, you know, and helping human beings be all that they can be, which is immense. And I want to learn about how we can create communities and companies that create that space for people to be everything they can be. And so from that kind of, that was the first time I came in contact with the idea of purpose. And from that, I followed that all my working life, and it's worked out really well. I've had a really fulfilling career. So even out of things that are challenging, great things can come. And I rather suspect that I've been better in HR than I would have been if I could.
Well, you might have done HR in the army. You never know. But what led you, obviously, then? So, you know, thinking of that and what you wanted to do, you joined Unilever in your 20s then. Most of your career has been in HR now. How was mental health regarded when you first started your HR career?
I don't think we talked about it massively. So I've been in HR and Unilever for 27 years. 27 years ago, mental health was not a massive conversation. And so I think it's changed enormously. I think the priority of it in for businesses, the awareness of it in the workplace has changed. I think the understanding that businesses have a role to play in creating workplaces that are supportive of people's mental health, I think that's all come on a huge amount. And I think in many countries in the world, the amount of stigma has come down. Now, we still have a huge amount to go on all of those things. But I think we have a lot more available than we did. So I've worked in a great company all my life, and there was mental health support and counselling available 27 years ago, but it didn't have the priority that it does now.
I still find even now, Tim, some people still aren't even aware, or through whatever reasons, they don't always understand that there are things such as employee assistance programs available, or occupational health, or they can have access to counselling in a lot of major companies. So it's still a bit of a best kept secret sometimes, isn't it, when you talk to people?
We have to work very, very hard, I think, to get... I think there's an order to this. First of all, I think we have to really work hard to put in place basic programs of support. And then once you've done that, I think you need to work hard in a business to raise awareness of those and reduce stigma, so that people acknowledge what's going on for themselves and then reach out for help. Then I think the third step is you've got to help line managers and leaders. So having leaders talk about it is a big shift. Senior leaders to really, you know, put this on the agenda. And then you need to help line managers spot signs and have sensitive conversations well. I think that's the kind of order, and you have to really work hard at those things. It's not one thing or the other, it's all of those steps. And it does take a lot of effort. There seems to be something about mental health that still makes people want to shy away from it in others, or not know how to deal with it in others, and makes people still have shame to experience mental ill health.
Yeah, you're absolutely right there. It certainly does. You know, you see it all the time. And even when I'm talking to people, if I'm running courses, if I'm talking to people in the street, or people that phone me up sometimes that talk about their own experiences, it's a recurring theme, that stigma that people have. When in the workplace then, what inspired you to become involved in mental health in the first place?
So I had a really fantastic job in Unilever of being kind of responsible for human resources in our business in the UK and Ireland. And we have had about 7,500 people in the business, in our factories, in our R&D labs, in our offices. And when you're working in a business like that, what's going on out in society is also what's going on in your company. And it started to become really clear that there was a big increase in mental ill health in society. And of course, that was showing up in our workplace, and that we really needed to think about how we could support people in the workplace. I came to the conclusion that actually the workplace is a great place to have conversations about mental health, because people come there to perform. They want to be their best. And so they're conscious of things that can get in the way. There are people around them who are all focused on helping those people to do the very best that they can. And it's a community in which we can have conversations about what's happening and how to care for each other. Actually, you know, work is basic. Well-managed work is good for people. And I think that, therefore, the workplace, for all those reasons, is a great place to have conversations about mental health. So we started to really work on how we could build on what we've been doing in the past, and try and take that to a new level to meet the challenge that people are facing. And we built a model that we've then scaled around the world, building on the experience of other companies across Unilever. And we follow a very simple approach, as I was talking about a few minutes ago. We focus on culture, lifting stigma, building awareness. We focus on leadership, senior leaders, and the space they create for this, and line managers. We focus on how we can support people when things go wrong, but also how we can help prevent mental ill health and promote good mental health.
So important. I mean, and say it's only, you know, I think you and what you were doing and Unilever were, you know, you were instrumental in getting things to start to change, weren't you? And I know Unilever was one of the founding partners at Heads Together campaign. And that was back in 2014, wasn't it? It was also at that time you started to acknowledge that you'd been having your own struggles, particularly with ongoing nightmares. Can you tell me about that, Tim?
Yeah, so in my 20s, I, not long after joining Unilever, actually, I had a really bad car accident. And during that accident, I thought I was going to die, basically. I thought that I was basically experiencing my last moments. Afterwards, I luckily wasn't physically that hurt, although the car kind of rolled a lot, and you know, it was a mess. I very fortunately got out alive and relatively unscathed. I then didn't really think about it again too much. I did have some difficult emotions at the point at which I thought I was going to die. I felt some kind of shame and regret. And so what I did do was basically say, next time I die, I won't have that shame and regret. I'm going to fulfill my potential and you know, in this life, so I don't regret it. That actually, I told as a story for years, and people said, that's great, turning a terrible thing to good. But actually, I wasn't doing myself a favor. I buried dealing with any of the emotions to do with this experience. And I turned it all into, I'm going to work really, really hard, and I'm going to be the best I can possibly be. And after that, I started to get to experience nightmares. And they weren't about a car crashing, they're about all kinds of other things. Although I was always dying in them. And this went on for years. And honestly, I just shrugged it off. I just thought, I'm a funny fella. It's, you know. And then over the years, it started to get worse. So it'd be 5 nights out of 7, several times a night, potentially I'd wake up screaming. And I started to not be able to avoid it. And at the same time, it's my behavior, I think my overreactions to things were getting worse. You know, and so basically what I now understand looking back is, in situations in which I was out of control, or things felt out of control, particularly things that would affect this kind of sense I had of always having to be my best and make the biggest impact on the world I could for, you know, for good, I would overreact. So those two things of, you know, of the deepening nightmares and my behavior, and then a line manager saying to me, kind of, Tim, you react a bit excessively to stuff, don't you? And no one had ever really said that to me before. And that actually really helped me to look at myself and go, you know what, I'm suffering at work because of all these emotions I have raging around in me, which I have to then control and manage, which is exhausting. I then not getting the rest because I'm having nightmares. And so I started to think, I've got something going on here. I need to get help. It came to a bit of a head when I was watching a film with my family one night, and it involved a lady having a car accident, and her car rolled over as well in this film. And I just couldn't watch it. I burst into tears and ran out of the room and stood in the kitchen thinking, there's something about the connection here. And I'd started, I suppose, to hear people talking about post-traumatic stress through, you know, things like Heads Together and I went to get help, and so that was the start of the journey of dealing with it.
How was it affecting you at work, Tim? Not being able to sleep, continually trying to, you know, overachieve, you know, putting things in boxes, putting them behind you, and looking forward rather than sort of looking at, you know, other things that were going on, the sort of behaviours, the way you were overreacting. How was it affecting you at work?
I think I suppose I was conscious of always having to manage myself, not in a normal way of just, you know, of just observing what's happening. And I was really having to manage myself. And I think it made me, I think I was a more difficult person. I was a less happy person. It was really hard work. Really.
It must have been very tiring and very stressful for you, Tim, as well. And you know, decision making process, that sort of stuff, must have been quite difficult.
So making work decisions, I was okay at. The problem was, I think it was more about being in this super networked environment, with somebody who was as hyper vigilant for things going wrong. That's exhausting, really exhausting. So I think I was less happy, a lot more tired, and overreacting, which is, it's not great to be around someone who is overreacting.
No. Well, how long did it take you to get help then? When did you actually go and see someone, you know, your GP or whatever, and what happened when you went to see that person?
So I did a classic mental, I suspect, thing, if I can gender stereotype, which I know it's probably in people, but I basically went to the doctor about something else, And at the end of having them check out that something else, said, listen, by the way, doc, I get these really bad nightmares. And the doctor looked at me and said, what, you? I said, yeah, it's been going on for years. I said, really? That's, I couldn't believe that. And he laughed. And I just went, okay, this isn't a thing you discuss with the doctor then. And I don't blame the doctor. You know, if I walk in a room, I'm a fairly kind of robust kind of person. You know, I suppose I strike someone that way. And you know, that's just what it is. And so I just kind of went away and it took me a few months before I went back and tried a different doctor. What
was it like when you spoke to the next doctor then, when you actually, you know, it must have taken a lot of effort and courage to actually go and see someone again after getting that sort of knot back. And then what did it feel like to actually, I suppose, be listened to and actually get a diagnosis?
Well, actually, what I did was, I'm very lucky. My company provides us with health insurance, and I researched online psychologists who specialise, in post-traumatic stress, and found one nearby and just called her. I remember it was just before Christmas, and she actually picked up the phone. It was the last working day before Christmas. She actually picked up her office phone. And I said, look, here, the reason I'm calling you is this, and I understand you work in this health network, and you know, this is my situation and my story. I told her for a few minutes, and she said, okay, great. I think we should meet after Christmas, and that was just brilliant. Someone who wants to talk about this and is positive about it, and I went to see her, and we started work on it. And the other thing I realized, Tom, is that another thing that was slightly holding me back was this kind of idea in my head of, well, what can someone do about it? It's like what it is, you know, I had this experience, it was awful, and can't undo it now.
Yeah.
And not realizing that there are treatments out there, lots of things that can be done to help. And this is something I find now in the work we do on mental health. It's very topical because of what COVID's doing to mental health.
Yeah, of course.
It's about sharing with people that there are solutions, there are treatments, and there are things you've never heard of. I'd never heard of EMDR, which is what I've been using, and I think it's really helped. I'd never heard of it, and yet you assume that there's no way you're going to get help, that there's nothing out there for you.
I find that really common. A lot of people don't realise that, for a start, they don't realise they're suffering from an anxiety problem or with anxiety anyway. And you're right, they don't realise that there's help available. Again, even, as you said, things like EMDR, CBT, people may have heard the acronyms or whatever, but they don't necessarily know what that is or what the purpose of it is or how that would help them anyway. So you're right, accessing services, getting a diagnosis and then, realizing that the help is actually there. There are treatments available. It's a bit of a revelation, isn't it?
It really is. And it's very heartening. Now, of course, I recognize I'm in a very privileged position. You know, I work in a big company. We have support like we do. And this is one of the worrying things that we have to, I think, work on. Those of us who are in the community of trying to care about mental health is we've got to make sure that support's there for everybody who needs it.
Yeah.
And the stigma is there for no one, wherever situation you're in, which I think is so important and why it's important that we have these conversations.
I found, self-stigma very debilitating for me. And I mean, I had to take time off after I was diagnosed. I know you did too. How did you find that? How did you find having to take some time off, and how did you find returning to work after you'd had a period of absence?
Yeah, so I found that I've had to work my way through several layers of self-stigma. First is I've got a thing that has a name that needs treatment. The second was when the psychologist said to me, look, Tim, you can't keep working like this and get better. You've got to stop. So talking to a person who's definition, whose whole drive has been, I will die only when I fulfill my potential. I will not have shame. And I've been driving all of this into work and then told you got to stop working. That moment, it took me quite a bit of time to go, yeah, okay, I get this. Then, of course, my company's been brilliantly supportive. So I went off 10, 12 weeks or so, did a lot of work, and then came back, honestly, too soon, with hindsight. And then the wonderful occupational health people say, you've been off work for 12 weeks. Now, they have this lovely expression of work hardened. You're not work hardened. You need to come back on a phased return. And I'm thinking, phased return. That's blown my kind of I'm off for a sabbatical story out of the water. Because you don't come back from some phased return. And I'm honest with my direct team that I work with, but I hadn't told people openly I was just taking a sabbatical. And so then having to kind of, you know, be more open about it. And then over time, being totally open about it, you know, I've made a film about it. The Heads Together team asked me to make a film about my story. I popped it on LinkedIn about a year ago. But that's several layers to go through of stigma, quite apart from whatever anyone else thinks about it. So that's quite a journey.
I just agree with you. I mean, it doesn't work for everyone. It's not right for everyone, but I found that as well. It's getting over the self-stigma, actually being, you know, getting over the fear of what other people would think about me and actually letting people know that I had this illness. For me, that was, it was a massive breath of fresh air. I didn't have to worry about what people thought anymore. I didn't have to hide anything anymore. So it makes a big difference, doesn't it? I think when you can actually get to that point where you can tell people.
Yeah, it does. It does. And but there's all kinds of other things that come out of it, isn't there? So I tell my story when it's relevant. I honestly try not to tell it all the time because I don't feel that it defines me either. This post-traumatic stress is not the defining thing of my life.
Yeah.
It's a thing that I've lived through and work with. I tell it when it's useful. And I find that when I do on leadership programs often, there's always someone who follows me out of the room and says, can I just have a word? And I also find, so it's opened up conversations I wouldn't otherwise had, but you know, I work in leadership development. It's part of what I do for a living is to try and help our business have the leaders that they need. But there's something else happening here, which is that actually leadership 20, 30 years ago was much more about, I have a kind of face of always being able to, always knowing what's going on, always got it together. There's no vulnerability. I think leadership in the 21st century has moved, and we need to show some vulnerability as leaders. People don't want to be led by job titles, people who have a face that they're not showing themselves through. People want to be led by humans.
Yeah.
And of course we need to be strong at times and to be resilient, but we also need to show ourselves. And I think that's another shift that's happening. I'm hoping, Tom, that shift in leadership to a more open, fluid, vulnerable form of leadership will help organizations shift and will help more people to be as open as they want to be. There's no requirement on anyone to tell their story publicly. I agree with you. Some of us take it on. Not everyone has to. But just as long as people can be open enough with themselves and the people they need to get help from, that's, I think, what really counts.
Many companies are worried, Tim, that if they set up programs to support mental health in the workplace, that they will see an increase in mental ill health. I've heard it myself. I've had people say it to me when I've had conversations with businesses. Can you understand that stance? And what did you see at Unilever?
Yeah, look, I think there's an important bit of context we should put in. We're sitting here in September 2020, the world's in the midst of a COVID pandemic. There is a massive increase in mental ill health taking place in the world anyway. And so, you know, pick your number. You know, I've seen some numbers suggesting in some countries between 35% and 60% of people have said they've had distress due to COVID. I've seen numbers as kind of 35% of people in the workplace, sometimes kind of more, have had a significant impact from COVID. I've seen numbers about, for example, in the US, the percentage of adults experiencing depressive or anxious symptoms going from like 11 to mid 20% of the population. So that's happening right now anyway. The question for us as companies is, do we want to create a space in which we acknowledge that and we meet that reality, or do we, would we rather ignore it? I don't think we have a choice. In fact, I know we have no choice but to face this as organizations. And we have no choice because in the 21st century, inhuman organizations, organizations don't care for their people, will simply be sidelined by people who won't work there and societies who won't accept them. Furthermore, in the 21st century, the work we tend to do is more and more creative, collaborative, and human. And so we need to bring our whole selves to work. And that whole self, in a significant proportion of the population, will have or be experiencing mental ill health. We need to face it and deal with it. So we have no choice, I think, but to face into this. Now, what, you're totally right that organizations do fear that the numbers are going to rise and the problems will become worse. The numbers will rise if you do this well, but the problem won't become worse. What will happen is that the problem that exists will become more transparent. And our experience has been that the numbers rise as people disclose more, but then the profile of cases that you have starts to change. And you, and some of the cases that are shorter, that people recover more quickly, they start to go more quickly. And have remaining is the more enduring cases of people who are really quite ill, who would be ill anyway, and who at least are now getting support. So it's a little bit like when you start safety in a big safety culture in a company. As people report, the numbers get worse. Your situation isn't getting worse. It's becoming more transparent.
Yeah, you can see it more. Yeah, you're absolutely right. These people aren't, you know, people are going to get ill anyway. You're absolutely right. And that's a conversation I have all the time. People are going to get ill anyway. They're not going to become more ill just because you decided to be more transparent about it or more open about it. You're just opening the gate, really, and making people feel more comfortable about discussing it or talking about it. I mean,
and right now, more people are becoming ill because
Yeah, there's so many variables that have you know, people's, you know, there are so many different factors out there. What's the cost to business overall then, when mental health and well-being isn't on their agenda, Tim, and not just cost financially, but
so you'll have seen the estimates as I have. Is it $1 trillion a year is the cost to business of mental ill health? In fact, I think that's actually of depression and anxiety alone. So it has a significant economic cost. The cost, by the way, to the world is even greater. So, you know, our company, like many, are deeply supportive of the sustainable development goals. We're not going to be able to achieve those goals unless we start to address mental health properly, systemically, and put the support in place. The cost to humanity of not supporting people with mental ill health and their families, that, by the way, is all of us, of course, because we all know somebody who's experienced mental ill health. So the cost of that is a huge loss of human potential. So we have an economic cost, we have a development cost. And for companies, as I said before, Tom, I think it's basically, this is now something that the generations coming into the workplace and the mood of the moment is, we will not be forgiving of companies that are not supportive of mental health, promoting methods of good mental health, and giving support to people when they struggle. We will not be attractive to people coming to work for us if we don't deal with it, and will not be attractive, supported by the societies in which we operate. I think this is really one that's become a fundamental for all companies.
Many people assume, I suppose, that HR are the experts and that line managers are trained in mental health and how to spot the signs, but we know that's generally not the case. What can companies do about educating their leadership teams to better understand mental health, Tim? And as you said, to pick up on these signs earlier and to be able to have better, more comfortable conversations when people do approach them about how they're feeling.
So there's quite a lot that can be done. And so line managers have a key role. I feel sorry for line managers because we ask them to do everything. Well-being and safety and performance management and target setting and budget management. And, you know, there's a lot going on to the shoulders of line managers. So it is necessary, I think, to train and support and make it clear what we expect and what we don't expect. And I think what we expect is that they're able to spot signs. They create relationships which are trusting, in which people are able to come forward. They're able to have good conversations and they're able to signpost to help. That's, I think, the role of the line manager. I think HR has a similar role, but also to have probably a slightly deeper knowledge of the support that's available out there, both in the company and beyond, probably to have that slightly deeper knowledge. But there's another key role which we're starting to really experiment with. I know is being used by many organizations around the world, which is to train other employees in the organization to also spot signs, to be available for a conversation and to signpost to support. And that, I think, is something that's massively powerful. Mental health first aiders or mental health champions, however you want to describe it, equipping the community to care for itself, to care for each other. That shifts the culture and it's signpost people to support and help. So I think those are the different things you can do as a company, and none of them are massively difficult to do. And I know that sometimes when people listen to maybe me talking about this and others from big companies, they think, oh, it's easy for you guys. You've got lots of resources. And of course, there's truth in that. We do have resources. But there are lots of things you can do that don't cost a lot of money. And there are lots of resources available. I'd like just to give a quick plug, if I could, to the Mental Health at Work website, which was initiated by the Heads Together campaign, curated by Mind with other mental health charities, and now companies donating their content. There's a lot of great stuff in there.
Yeah.
It costs nothing to go there.
So that's a really important, Sim, as well, isn't it? There are courses there that businesses can do if they're free for small businesses.
Yeah. And so for example, one of the big issues on people's minds right now is getting people back into workplaces or not. We passionately believe that this moment of in COVID, talking about returning or not returning to workplaces is a moment in which, if we create the space for people to talk to their line managers openly about their mental health, we will unstigmatize mental health massively. If, however, when that conversation happens, it is not possible for a person to speak about their mental health, if they don't feel safe and the line manager isn't skilled, we will stigmatize mental health again for another generation. What a critical moment. The line manager conversation is key. So we've donated to the Mental Health at Work website our conversation guide we've been using. Other organizations are doing the same. There's resources there for the situation that now Mind curated resources to help with mental health and COVID. So you're right, there's lots of stuff there. So this doesn't have to cost lots of money. I think it's more about having a structure, culture, leadership, prevention, support, doing things in each of those areas that really work for the audience that you have, and just having a deep commitment to stay at it, not to make it the mood of the moment.
Yeah, that's another thing, isn't it? There's always a fear that people will just go, right, we'll stick half a dozen people on a course. They do the course, that's the end of it. You know, it's so much more than that. It's about changing culture and deeply embedding that culture and thought process into the organization at a higher level. You're talking about COVID, obviously, because, you know, it is affecting us all. And, you know, 2020 has been extremely challenging for everybody. It doesn't matter the size of your company, really. What support is Unilever giving to employees to help them to continue to work from home, Tim? Because I know that's a challenge for a lot of people.
Yes, look, it's really difficult. And you know, working from home plays out differently for different people. So if you are living alone, maybe for some of our younger employees, they may either live alone or they may live in a shared house, shared property, not having a nice office to sit in, maybe sitting at the end of their bed with a laptop on an ironing board. That's a kind of harder reality. Obviously, there are people for whom home isn't quite as safe a place. So working from home is having different effects on different people. And this is obviously going to go on for a while. By the way, we also have a lot of people who are working in workplaces. You know, we have factories around the world, which are fantastic factory teams, are continuing to work, making products that people need. So we have to support people in those different realities, in those different situations. So you mentioned employee assistance programs earlier. And I've heard sometimes going to conferences on wellbeing, people being a bit sniffy about them. But they are so basic and so necessary. You've got to put in place support for people and their families where they can go and just ask whatever question, whatever help they need. So we have an employee assistance program available to our people in every country in which we operate around the world. And we keep trying to promote it and helping people to go use it, whether it's by calling or by going onto their website and finding information. That's a basic. I think it's also, we've been starting to train mental health champions. It's about starting to help line managers think about how can you connect people. I've been everywhere I've gone, I've been urging team leaders to have check-ins with their teams, to start every time you have a team meeting, to go around the group and ask everyone to, even if it's as quick as a thought, a feeling, or it could be if you have a longer meeting, to say, I want to hear from everybody how you are. We've got to get those emotions in articulated. Again, they're there. The only question is whether we're creating a safe enough space as leaders for people to bring those to work with them. So check-ins, we've been briefing people on how to do a mental health check-in. How do you start that conversation with people if it's not something that's ever been discussed before? So a lot of different things. There's no one answer, but we're trying a lot of things to try and help line managers, help leaders. And with World Mental Health Day coming, it's a great moment for all of us in organizations to really send the message out that we all have mental health. We're all always on a spectrum from very healthy to very unhealthy. We will move up and down that spectrum. And right now, many more people are feeling the pressure on their mental health than ever before. So I think one of the big things we do is to try and continually communicate about it, particularly at a time like this.
You know, many businesses, we're looking now maybe at a downturn, financial downturn in the economy. And I know there are a lot of people out there that are worried about the future anyway. And of course, you know, there have been significant redundancies in some organizations already. There are probably more to come over the coming months. What support the teams need to get through this, do you think? What, you know, to help them to get through uncertainty? Also thinking about maybe if there is, in fact, process of redundancy, and support for those that lose their jobs.
So if I could maybe focus on how we help people deal with uncertainty. It's completely against human nature. We don't like uncertainty. As human beings, we like kind of predictable, we're habit forming, and we're in a situation in which it's deeply, deeply uncertain. And I do think this is an area we're spending actually a lot of time on, is helping us all to manage that. When we talk about leadership in Unilever, and by the way, I'm talking about everybody then, because in a fast flowing, kind of agile, uncertain world, everybody's a leader. We talk about the inner game and the outer game. And in the inner game, we talk about purpose, working from purpose. We talk about personal mastery, bringing your best self. And we talk about agility, always being curious and courageous. And in that inner game, part of it, think particularly in personal mastery, is how do we manage living in uncertainty? And the kinds of things we are talking about is the art of really being present. As human beings, we can often find our attention wandering to the past, or we find our attention wandering to the future. What might happen? That's generally not a very happy set of thoughts. That's generally where the worry comes in.
Yeah.
So helping people learn the techniques of how you can be deeply present in the moment. And of course, we can only really work well when we're in the present. We can only really engage deeply with the teams around us when we're present. That part of being in the present is a key part of it. It's much harder to worry about the future when you're really in the present. So we're spending a lot of time talking about that and teaching techniques like box breathing. You know, which helps you to calm down the limbic system, to activate the parts of the brain that deal with, you know, cognitive control and big picture thinking. If you can activate those pieces and deactivate the kind of this fight or flight response, you help people to have more calm to respond to situations. I think it's not easy to change what's coming at you, but you can change how you respond. And we spend a lot of time with our leaders and our teams trying to focus on those kinds of things to empower us to use what resources we have to meet the challenge around us.
Yeah, it's, you know, changing how you think, you know, learning to accept that the future is unpredictable. You know, it is key. It's absolutely key. We, you're right. We like to think that we're in control. We like to think that we know what's happening, what's going to go on around the corner, roughly. But I think learning to accept that we can't control the future, and we need to sort of take things as they come and concentrate in the here and now and what we can do at this present moment is so important for people to help them to not worry so much.
Yeah, indeed.
Tim, thank you so much for being my guest today. It's been absolutely lovely to talk to you. And thank you for being a mentally healthy leader.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to talk with you, Tom. It's been great. And I really hope that these kind of conversations continue and we can make the change in the world that we really need.
Thank you, Tim. Great words.
Thank you.
Mentally Healthy Leaders from Thoughtify.
My next guest is Kate Davies, CBE. Kate is the Director of Health and Justice, Armed Forces and Sexual Assault Referral Centres for NHS England. Kate has developed, led and increased provision for survivors of sexual violence. She was a member of the government's independent board for the Prison Drug Treatment Strategy and has been Director of Black and Ethnic Minority Communities Engagement, focusing on the health and social care of diverse groups who experience discrimination and or disadvantage. Under her leadership, a new framework of mental health services for the armed forces community has been developed, including the forthcoming Veterans Mental Health High Impact Service. If you'd like to get in touch with us about mental health training in your organisation or executive coaching, then visit fortify.co.uk for more information. Check out our website at www.fortify.co.uk. You can also search for us on social media at Fortify Limited. My name's Tom Fox. Thanks for listening to Mentally Healthy Leaders.